Hello and welcome to our program. My name is Robert Mayberry and I will be reading Esquire Magazine Summer 2022 here on Sight in the Sound Radio. The following program may contain material which sensitive listeners may find objectionable. Listener discretion is advised. On the cover of the Summer 2022 edition of Esquire Magazine is Elliot Page. Some of the articles: The Euphoria of Elliot Page, What Every Man Should Know About a Post-Roe World, Damn Good Advice for Fathers, The Best Bars in America. And let's begin. Letter from the editor. Elliot Page showed up at the Esquire offices the way most famous people would on a Thursday afternoon in New York, discreetly. Black t-shirt, jeans, baseball cap pulled low. As he passed my office, I looked up from my Zoom meeting and said to the person on the screen, "I think Elliot Page just walked by." This wasn't a random pop-up. He was here for a fitting. The following day, we would be photographing Page for the 1,064th cover of Esquire. So he spent the next hour with stylist Bill Mullen in Esquire's fashion department, trying on some very expensive clothes. The fitting marked the penultimate step in the lengthy process of executing an Esquire cover shoot. The process begins in earnest with a question: who should be on the cover? In its 89 years, Esquire has featured on its cover a dozen U.S. presidents, countless world-famous athletes, actors, and musicians, and Truman Capote three times. We don't make the decision lightly. Who's creating work and making noise in ways that amaze us? Who meets the cultural moment? The person we're looking for, we call him an Esquire man. Finding him requires multiple conversations with Esquire's senior staff, starting with the executive director of talent, Randy Peck, who tracks celebrities and determines who best reflects the brand and is likely to make the greatest impact. She's usually correct. Then we weigh the options, an intense, deeply unscientific process that can take weeks, even months. Once we reach something like a consensus, our creative team gets to work, developing a concept for the photo shoot. What mood are we going for? What do we want to say with this cover? Which photographer will help us achieve it? For Page, the inspiration we came up with was young Hollywood. James Dean in the 50s, Richard Gere in the 80s, River Phoenix and Leo DiCaprio a decade later. Rockwell Harwood, Esquire's design director, describes it as being a fly on the wall at a place like the Viper Room in the 90s. Being around these men who were given an opportunity to explore their versions of masculinity. For Elliot, it was giving him a character and a narrative to play with. The fashion followed. According to Harwood, the vibe was, you don't give a shit. But you do give a shit. As always, the goal was to create a cover image that is nothing short of iconic. Elliot Page is an icon. He earned an Academy Award nomination at 20 for Juno, has starred in big budget hits as well as indie darlings, came out as queer in 2014, made the riveting Viceland show Gaycation, and in December 2020 revealed that he is transgender, with his starring role on the Netflix blockbuster The Umbrella Academy. Page is playing a trans superhero. Read his story, told in the style of Esquire's long-running franchise, What I've Learned, on page 64. At the cover shoot, I joined Harwood and contributing visual director James Morris beside the monitor as photographer Reuven Alfanador guided Page through the poses. Mullen jumped on sets between shots to tweak the clothes. As images of Page flashed on the screen, we exchanged glances but didn't say a word. We shared a tacit understanding. Something special was happening. Page brought an ease to wearing the clothes and an undeniable intense confidence to the camera. He, Afanador, and Mullen were in a groove. They blew past the designated lunch hour. I didn't want to disrupt the flow, but in between looks, as Paige strode from the dressing area back to the set, I spoke with him briefly, sharing what had been clear to us all. He looked iconic, an Esquire man, by Michael Sebastian, editor-in-chief. And next, out of the blueprint section, Dave Holmes' America. The strong, silent type will not shut up. My dad's chair, of all things, might be the secret to our culture-wide freak-out about men. My dad had one of those big chairs, oxblood leatherette, brass tack trim, an ottoman for the feet, and a wingback for the head. A piece a decorator would call masculine. A chair for reading three paragraphs of a book and then immediately napping. A dad chair. It was one of the things I wanted from Mom and Dad's place in St. Louis when we cleared it out last Christmas. I found a guy who was moving cross-country and paid him $400 to drive it from St. Louis to L.A. My dad was part of a silent generation, born between world wars. He was a Marine, a devout Catholic man who wore a necktie to a serious office full of serious chairs. He got himself a proper office job in the 50s and then started his own business. That business was successful enough for us to move into bigger and bigger houses. He eventually won large enough for his own office and his own chair. Dad and my brothers, boomers, both of them had an ease with one another, a fluency in the language of sports and the stock market. And because I am so out of my depth in this department, I cannot think of a third guy thing. Let's say escrow. In the context of my family, the boys still means the three of them. My brothers took over the family business, and because they are smart and hardworking and know what things like escrow are, they've grown it into something bigger. That's how they've supported their families and built their own houses with their own dad chairs. I'm one of those Generation X boys who listened to the Smiths, and I liked to be in plays. Dad knew he had a different kind of boy on his hands because Andy Griffith Show reruns taught me that fishing was a critical element in a father and son relationship. I once told my dad, "I don't know why we don't fish. We should fish." "Do you want to fish?" he asked. I thought about it for a second or two and said, "Oh, God, no." And we laughed. If we struggled sometimes to find things to talk about, that just meant more time to be quiet together. A lull in the conversation can feel like a failure when you're talkers like us, in a family of talkers like ours. But sometimes it isn't. Sometimes it's just comfort, acceptance. My father died on New Year's Eve 2016. I miss him every single day. But I'm actually a little relieved he did not live to see what's happening to men now. Not how men are changing from shouldering more of the work at home to challenging gender norms, but how many of them are reacting to these changes. I write this in a moment when there's a Tucker Carlson original called The End of Men, featuring a practice called testicle tanning. It blasts your balls with red light. It's been right in front of us this whole time to allegedly boost testosterone, which I guess increases your appetite for sports talk, radio, gay jokes, and premature heart disease. Joe Rogan sneered when Pete Buttigieg took paternity leave. Isn't that supposed to be for a person who gave birth? Missouri Senator Josh Hawley has said he plans to make masculinity a signature political issue. A man is a father. A man is a husband. A man is somebody who takes responsibility, said the guy who pumped his fist at the insurrectionist crowd on January 6th, yet refuses to accept any responsibility for inciting them. We are in the throes of a culture-wide freakout over what is and is not masculine. You may have noticed that many of us are not taking it well. In fact, can someone please check on David Mamet? The tough guys are claiming victimhood. The men who mock you for talking about your feelings are yelling about theirs. The strong, silent type simply will not shut up. The New York Times did a roundtable with conservative men this spring, one of whom complained that America is too weak. Another said he's personally affronted when he sees a man in insufficiently masculine clothing. It's weird in here right now, and it has been since at least a few months before a news network told guys to sunburn their sacks so they don't end up like me. We live in a nation of talkers, braggers, yellers, and criers, when our best ideal is to irradiate our scrotums to keep us mean. Maybe it's worth being quiet for a while. Standing in the way of evolution does not make anyone a man. It doesn't make them a woman either. It makes them a child. The chair arrived last month. The guy carried it to the front porch, shook my hand, and drove off, leaving my boyfriend, Ben, and me to bring it into the house. It wouldn't fit through the front door. We had to go the back way through the carport, in through the double doors, up over my desk, and into the corner I cleaned out for it. It's too big for the space. I have to hurdle the ottoman so I can get behind my desk. It belongs in a very serious man's office, so it sticks out in here, underneath the framed ad for the New Wave Records. The dissidence is what makes it beautiful. The old can peacefully, even beautifully, exist among the new. And the three of us, my brothers and I, traditional and masculine or not, all still get to be our father's son. You're listening to Robert Mayberry on Sight and the Sound Radio. You can listen to Sight and the Sound on HD4 on 88.7 KUHF, channel 8.5 on TV, streaming on your computer or smartphone, as well as your smart speaker. You can also listen at your convenience on our podcast page at sightandthesound.org. We are Sight and the Sound Radio since 1967. Okay, we will backpedal to the April-May edition of Esquire magazine and conclude the article, The Dream of Oscar Isaac, in which the star of Moon Knight survives a hurricane, floats on a warm ocean, lives in a model home, makes movies, wanders around his apartment, wears tie-dye, trips on mushrooms, hosts SNL, stars in Star Wars, and creates art that gets at the rich and baffling complexity of human experience, but not necessarily in that order. The second house. Isaac leans back in a chair in a different house now, also in Florida, a home he bought for his mother when he became a star. He wears a black T-shirt and baseball cap. A painting hangs on a pale blue wall. It is sea green, with what looks like a mountainous landscape rising from water, surrounded by low-hanging clouds. Tomorrow marks the day, 5 years ago, that his mother died from pancreatic cancer in this house. And so tomorrow, he and his family, including his wife and two young sons, will walk on the beach and throw flowers into the ocean, a way to remember the woman who took him to his first audition, who drove him to everyone during those early years. She stood next to him in Canes in 2010, and she was beside him when he got his first Golden Globe nomination for Inside Llewellyn Davis in 2014. She watched everything, he said, smiling. His voice grows soft here, tender. She kept a scrapbook. She did everything. We are speaking over Zoom, and at one point he suggests a break to get coffee. 10 minutes, he says. Precisely 10 minutes later, he reappears. Got a coffee, wiped the kid's butt. Good to go, he says. Those days in the model home should have been full of happiness and excitement, but the family was slowly falling apart. His mother was suffering from kidney problems and had to start dialysis. And his father was often gone at work. His parents weren't getting along. Oscar took refuge in his imagination. He wrote plays that were turned into musicals at school. Short stories about a mockingbird in a cuckoo's nest where it doesn't belong, knocking the eggs over. About a platypus on Noah's Ark, skeptical about the coming flood. And he made those short movies about invincibility. His characters fought each other on camera, one side of himself battling and defeating the other. Isaac has, of course, made friends, good friends over the years, friends who feel like family, or a different kind of family. One is Pedro Pascal, whom he met when they both acted in an off-Broadway play. We have very similar backgrounds, Pascal says. We're both children of Latin immigrants, so there's sort of a cultural familiarity. Then, at the same time, we're both actors. We have the same dreams. It's something very special because it can be a lonely journey when you're out there going after it. It sounds corny, but you're going after your dreams. And to find family along the way, he pauses, laughs. The other side of it is that he's the younger brother I never wanted. After Hurricane Andrew destroyed that model home, his parents separated. Oscar, his siblings, and their mother moved again to another house. It was a large and spacious and sat on 5 acres. Its rooms waiting to be filled with memories and new hopes. Her dream house, he says. Oscar's mother put everything she had into purchasing it, leaving no money for furniture. 3 years later, she would undergo a kidney transplant and be forced to sell it. She had to move away again to another town. But it was just before Oscar's senior year of high school. So he didn't want to leave the school district. For that last year, he slept on a couch at a friend's house so he could graduate with his classmates. For me, Isaac says, she was unconditional love. And when she died, it felt like God died too. God. Oscar was born in Guatemala and came to the United States when he was 6 months old. He grew up in a deeply religious household and in a community of evangelical Guatemalan immigrants who felt they must be prepared for the apocalypse, who envisioned the physical world as the arena for spiritual warfare, who worried if they were not righteous enough, if they did not believe enough, they would not get called up to heaven and the second coming of Jesus Christ. We would have church in our house, he says. We would have traveling pastors from Guatemala stay at our house. For us, it was like the end of days was all around us all the time. The sense of the apocalypse, the sense that we were going to get left behind, the mark of the beast. There was a picture up. I remember my grandmother had this big painting of Jesus knocking on the United Nations. This huge Jesus. It was terrifying. I know the one, I tell him. When I first arrived in the U.S. from East Africa, I went to school and attended church with evangelicals. And that picture that Isaac mentions hurdles me back to my own childhood, to the fire and brimstone preachers, to that pastel blue Jesus he calls Godzilla Jesus, standing in front of a huge building. We exchange memories of how frightened we were as young children, seeing that image of an oversized, elongated Christ standing at the United Nations. Neither of us yet understood the function of the UN, but we were starting to have a sense of a world that needed to be controlled and patrolled by a greater spiritual force, manifest and a man who looked nothing like the communities from which we came, who looked like no real human at all. To put it bluntly, that shit was scary. It was terrifying and oppressive and damaging, whether an adult or a child. It feels like something directly out of my nightmare, he says. It was a form of spiritual abuse. There's like a real spiritual abuse. So this year's really been about trying to cultivate a healthy relationship with spirituality, because I went the opposite way, pure materialistic, because of all that spiritual trauma, he says. If I couldn't see it and couldn't touch it, I didn't want to deal with it. His sister and he talk about those childhood days of constant fear and uncertainty, the stifling rules and paralyzing judgment, the purported possessions and exorcisms, and the continual awareness that so many of our natural inclinations can be termed sin. So much of who we are can hurl us into a fiery hell and eternal damnation. His sister is a climate scientist now, so her profession is end of days, he says. He turned away from religion, from anything that resembled a belief in a higher power and divine intervention. Recently, he started to reconsider what spirituality meant without the oppressive and controlling features. I'm trying to move back to a sense of something bigger than myself, he says. There's obvious beauty and importance in connection with spirituality, but man, can it get hijacked. A dark stage, silence. Isaac transforms into a disillusioned 60s intellectual in a restless, radical enclave of New York City. The play, The Sign, in Sidney Brunstein's Window, written by Lorraine Hansberry and published in 1964, is an examination of the hypocrisies that exist in even the most bohemian liberal communities. It is a play about art and its potential to disturb and confound, and about the sacrifices and risks that making art entails. There he is, the lights coming on. This is one of his dreams. The Sign in Sidney Brunstein's Window is a project Isaac dreams of doing. Hansberry, the first black woman to have a play produced on Broadway, A Raisin in the Sun, in 1959, challenged society's sense of decorum, asked what respectability meant when it continues to allow and participate in discrimination and bigotry. Brunstein's Window was the last play that she wrote before she died at the age 34 from pancreatic cancer in 1965. In a way, we're living in an almost Victorian time, Isaac says. It's not about what you really believe. It's about what you're going to get called out on. I even noticed when I did 4 productions during COVID, and even the COVID protocols were all vastly different from production to production, because it really wasn't about safety. It was about liability, right? It was about what might we be called out on if there's an outbreak, if this person gets sick, if that person gets sick. So it depended on who was running the show and how freaking crazy they were and how much they wanted to defend their position in their job. Then within that, of course, there's safety, and we want to do the right thing, and we don't want people to get sick. But that's not what it's really about. A lake in Hungary. Isaac and Ethan Hawke are at a lake in Hungary on a break from Moon Knight rehearsals. They are tripping on mushrooms, lying in the grass, soaking in the sun. A live phosphorescent album plays in the background. Maybe on somebody's phone. Everything is expansive, glowing, harsh lines melting, and a sun, a cascade of light falling like stars. Oscar's floating again, back in the ocean, back at home in his mother's house. He is somewhere between ascent and freefall, in that suspended place where the imagination rises to make contact with the divine, the music soaring and aching, steady and gentle, the deep thrum of the bass, the reverb, the hush in the crowd, audible even from this place. Here is joy. It is a tender gift to a cup in the hand and protect. Here is mercy. It's all going to be all right. Keep going. Keep doing what you're doing, because it matters. It's beautiful. Oscar is both dreaming and finally on solid ground, the earth steady beneath him. The crowd cheers. Here is a dream. Remember it. Hold on tight. And this concludes the article. We have come to the end of our program. I've been reading Esquire magazine, April, May, and summer of 2022. I'm Robert Mayberry, and this has been a production of Sight and the Sound Radio, Houston, Texas.